Good morning. It's Monday, October 30th. This is Mountain Money on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley with my guest co-host, Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning on a very chilly Monday here in Park City.
It is a chilly Monday. Doug Wells is not here with us this morning. I suspect he may have known it was going to be a late game five last night and he wanted to sleep in. What do you think?
I suspect that's correct. As I said to you earlier, Renee, if baseball were like that all the time, I'd actually watch it more. I mean, it was really exciting.
No spoiler alerts for anybody who may have recorded the game because it went on late, but there were extra innings and it was an exciting finish. And game six is tomorrow, Halloween. It should be exciting. So, also exciting, our show coming up this hour. The Olympics has been a big buzzword, especially in the past 2 weeks after the Utah Sports Commission announced that it was going to form an exploratory committee to see whether Utah should make a bid for hosting another Winter Games. There's a lot of good that comes with the Olympics. Some people might say there's a not so good side that comes with the Olympics. That comes down to the bottom line, finances. We're going to talk to a leading sports economist, Dr. Victor Matheson. He's a professor of economics and accounting at the College of the Holy Cross. He's written a lot about the economic viability of the Olympic Games, Roger. It's going to be a great conversation.
And later on this morning, we will have here in the studio Patty Johnson and Chef Sebastian Silberius from Element Park City. I, for one, am hoping they show up with some samples for us, but we're looking forward to talking to them. And then finally, after that, we'll be having Ann Martin and Chris Hanneman from Get Organized. And these are serial organizers who help other people deal with their chaos. I know I could use some help with that.
They're going to be interesting to talk to because we could probably all use a little organizing in our lives, I think. The time is coming up on 9:09. We will get started with the show right after these underwriters.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money here on KPCW. Kicking off our show, the Olympics, and are they good for business? On October 19th, the Utah Sports Commission announced an exploratory committee that will be formed to look into whether Utah should make another bid for the Winter Games. As everyone out there knows, we hosted the 2002 Winter Games. Park City played host to about half of the venues for that game, for those games, excuse me. Should we make another bid? If we do, it'd probably be for the 2030 games, possibly 2026 games. This committee needs to make its recommendation to the state legislature on February 1st. They're going to be holding a lot of public meetings, so get ready to make your opinions heard to our local officials on that. Here's someone who might help you make up your mind about whether you want the Olympics back here. Dr. Victor Matheson joins us on the phone, professor of economics and accounting at the College of the Holy Cross. Good morning, Dr. Matheson.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here this morning or joining us over the phone. First question, are the Olympics good for the host city?
So the experience that we've had over about the last 20 or 30 years is that overall, the Olympics do cause some level of economic benefits to any of these host communities. Unfortunately, for most host cities, the amount of money you have to spend to get those benefits vastly outweighs the total benefits that you might get from the Olympics. So, for example, let's go back just a few years to Sochi. Sochi certainly benefited from a huge boost in tourism during the Olympics, but for all those people that they brought in, they ended up spending $51 billion to do it. There's no way that even 50 years or 100 years of tourist boost is going to be able to pay for that $51 billion price tag.
Dr. Matheson, I got a chance over the weekend to read some of your writings on the economics of the Olympics, which I found absolutely fascinating. And as I went through it, I did see this pattern of expenditures that exceed the benefits. I like the way you break down the categories of benefits and the categories of expenditures. But what I'd like to ask you is, how much have you focused on what happened here in Salt Lake City in 2002 and the economic impact of that, both on the positive and the negative side?
Yeah, so we've looked at Salt Lake City for a couple things. So let's talk about the benefits to Salt Lake City. So first of all, if you actually look back at the data and see what happened to employment in Utah and in Salt Lake City and, of course, in Park City and the counties that hosted events, what we did see is we did see a very noticeable increase in employment for about a one-year period around the Olympics. And in total, that added to about 7,000 additional jobs above what we would normally have expected in Utah over that time period. So that's a very real benefit. Mind you, that the predictions of the Olympics were for about 35,000 new jobs, but still, we did see a clear bump in employment for a year that was identifiable. We also saw some very clear increases in taxable sales at places around, again, Park City and Salt Lake City. We saw big increases in the amount of economic activity at bars and restaurants and at hotels. Mind you, that was countered by actual reductions in taxable sales at general retail stores, things like the Walmarts and Targets. And actually, the one industry that actually did very, very poorly during the first quarter of 2002 actually might be a surprise, but the one industry that did most poorly in Utah over that time period was actually ski resorts themselves. You know, they don't make money when people come in to watch other people skiing. They make money when people come in to do the skiing themselves. Actually, the data suggests that the 2002 Winter Olympics were actually very good for ski resorts in Colorado.
But the 2002 Games did benefit the ski resorts after the Games were over in subsequent years, didn't it?
Right. So it does look like the advertising that Salt Lake and Utah in general got from the Olympics did result in some long-term gains in skier visits. So, for example, again, comparing Utah to Colorado, Utah had a very poor skier year in 2002 compared to Colorado, as actual skiers avoided the ski watchers. But in 2003, over the next roughly 10 years, growth in skier visits in Utah did exceed those of the resorts next door in Colorado. So it looks like there was some advertising effect that lingered for some amount of time after the Olympics.
Is there any way to quantify that, or have you tried?
Yeah, so people have tried to do that. It's really hard to know because, again, I think starting in 2002, you know, the Utah ski industry was less developed, less mature than the Colorado one. So you might have expected higher growth rate in, you know, at Snowbird and Alta and those places than you would have had in Colorado at the Vales and the Keystones. So it's hard to account for those trends, but all that put together, it does look like we had a little bit higher growth rate in the ski industry in Utah than in Colorado after the Olympics. And so certainly it would be fair to maybe chalk up some of that to the advertising that Utah got during the Games.
One of the things that was talked about widely at the time was an anticipated real estate value increase here in Park City in particular. And everyone said the Olympics are going to create an enormous boom. And I wonder how that fits into the calculation, A, whether it really happened, and B, to what extent it could be attributable to the Olympics.
So I can't comment on the real estate industry there. This is not something I've looked at all. What we have seen in other cities that have hosted the Olympics is often a kind of a boom-bust cycle, because you have a huge amount of investment right around the Olympics because, again, hoteliers and restaurateurs are trying to get large, you know, projects in place so that they can accommodate the big crowds at the Olympics. But then once the Olympics go and all the crowds disappear, all of a sudden you've overbuilt for what you've got. I know certainly in Utah, Utah had pretty low hotel occupancy rates following the Olympics, again, because they kind of overbuilt hotels. What we saw in Lillehammer after the Winter Olympics there is several of the top five-star hotels built for the Olympics declared bankruptcy within 6 months after the Games. I know that didn't happen in Utah, but it certainly is something that you can do, is that you overbuild for the Olympics. And so rather than this big increase in valuations following the Olympics, you get a big run-up in prices before the Olympics and then a collapse afterwards.
And you mentioned Salt Lake City and Barcelona might be unique in the successes they saw. Why is that?
Yeah, so one of the nice things about these places is I call them hidden gems. These are places that really are great tourist destinations. Again, I've been skiing. I grew up in Colorado, but I have skied in Utah and obviously wonderful places there, but, you know, not known for their recreational activities as much as other places around the country. And so if you can advertise something that people don't know about, that really gets them the chance to say, this is a place I hadn't thought about going, and now I will. Barcelona, same sort of thing. Before the summer games there in the 90s, they were only about the 10th most popular tourist destination in Europe. Following this huge, basically 3 months of worldwide advertising during the Olympics, they got to show off what's a really wonderful city and again, a hidden gem. And then they're now the fourth most popular tourist destination in Europe. Of course, we'll see what the current political upheaval is going to do to that. But, you know, compare that to a London. London had the Olympics, but London can't claim that the Olympics put London on the map. It was already the most popular tourist destination in the world, and a bunch of advertising doesn't help them because they're already filled to the gills with tourists. Same thing with Atlanta. Atlanta doesn't have that much to offer a tourist from abroad, and so even having the Olympics there doesn't do a whole lot for the tourism trade after the Olympics are gone, because they don't have that much to offer once the big event packs up.
So have any Utah officials reached out to you in the past 2 weeks?
So no, although, and you know, I'm generally known as a big critic of the Olympics. That being said, Utah actually probably does make sense, certainly more than just about any other place in the world. The IOC has had a huge trouble over the last 5 years getting cities that are willing to host their event. During the last Winter Olympics, 5 of the 7 original bidding cities all backed out, mainly because of public outcry about the potential expenses. The last 2 cities left were Beijing and Almaty in Kazakhstan, and of course these are places where the public's voice doesn't matter too much, not exactly beacons of democracy in either of those places. And so I think the IOC is desperately looking for cities willing to step up and host, which means a place like Salt Lake City is likely to get a sweetheart deal from the IOC. On top of that, lots of the infrastructure is already in place. I was at a conference maybe 3 or 4 years ago with Didi Corandini, the former mayor of Salt Lake, and she thought at that time that Salt Lake might be able to put on the Olympics for about $2 billion, roughly the same price that it cost them in 2002. And we can argue about whether $2 billion is worthwhile spending, but at least that's in the ballpark, as opposed to these, you know, $51 billion Olympics in Sochi or $45 billion Olympics in Beijing.
Let's say the governor of Utah, mayor of Salt Lake, and mayor of Park City give you a call tomorrow. You're on a conference call, and they say, Dr. Matheson, what do you advise? Should we go for the Olympics again?
I would say, you know, put a little money into putting a bid together and seeing what it might cost you to put this on. But be willing to walk away from it if the IOC doesn't come up with enough money to be able to counteract a lot of those costs. But it's certainly, again, Salt Lake is, again, one of the few plausible places where the Olympics can be done reasonably and without breaking the bank. Same thing in Los Angeles, which, of course, is hosting the 2028 Summer Games. Again, the United States has a pretty good track record of not letting you know, these things get out of control. We haven't seen these massive cost overruns like we saw in Russia, huge costs associated with Olympics in London, or the worst of all actually is the upcoming World Cup in Qatar in 4 years, where the total price tag there might be as high as $200 billion.
And I take it that part of the reason you say that relates to the infrastructure that's still in place here from 2002. I know that I went to Barcelona, and I was hearing you talk about Barcelona and saw weeds growing in what were the ruins of the former Olympic sites there. In contrast, I think that most of the Utah sites are actively being used and could probably be refurbished at a relatively reasonable price to host the next games.
Right, and one of the problems with the Olympics, both the Summer and Winter Games, is they have a bunch of fairly obscure sports that there are not large numbers of cities across the country and across the world that have all of these facilities in place. Not many places have world-class bobsledding runs. Not many places have world-class speed skating ovals. And so it's hard to find places that have these things in place, and of course Utah does. I might have argued against Utah trying for the 2002 Olympics, but once you've already spent all that money and built up your infrastructure, you might as well use it as much as you can. And so it certainly is plausible that that Utah could come out ahead in a new in a winter bid here coming up.
As an economist, what do you think of our model with the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, which was given $76 million to subsidize the operations of Utah Olympic Park, Utah Olympic Oval? They now have Soldier Hollow under their operations as well. And right 2 weeks ago, when they announced the formation of this exploratory committee, they also released, they being the state legislature, a performance audit of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, which said that it's running $4 million in the red every year, and that the Olympic Legacy Foundation will run out of money probably in, I think it's 17, 18 years. So I looked at that and thought, is Utah going after another Olympic Games to keep these venues viable? What's your opinion of the Legacy Foundation?
Well, so it's very, very difficult to find uses for these huge facilities once the games are gone, right? And that's not just Winter Olympics; it's also Summer Olympics. You know, no city needs a 20,000 seat swimming facility, and so you often have the white elephant issue. Obviously, things are still being used in Utah, but of course, they're not being used at the level that they were originally designed for, which is, you know, a world-class Olympic event. So what you end up seeing is these facilities often do need subsidies in order to stay viable through time. And, of course, that's what happens, is that sometimes the legacy is not this great legacy of name recognition and positive infrastructure. Sometimes it's a legacy of infrastructure that actually takes a lot of resources to keep up and running year after year. But, of course, that's all the more reason why if you get an opportunity to use your expensive infrastructure, you should get out and use it. You know, it's like, think about the china at home. You know, you get it all for your wedding, and you should, and then it just sits there. Well, if you can figure out some events to actually, you know, put out the nice china and the silver, maybe you should do it.
Is the model that Utah followed with you know, retaining this fund and trying to use it to sort of subsidize the operating losses, is that a typical model?
So I would say it's probably not typical in to the extent that here we are 15 years later and most of the facilities are in reasonably good shape. Compare that to even Brazil just a couple years ago. Already some of those facilities have fallen into complete disrepair. Look at Greece. They had an Olympics roughly the same time as Salt Lake City, and huge numbers of their facilities are completely empty. No water in the pools, grown over fields, dilapidated buildings. And so the fact that Salt Lake City and Utah thought well enough ahead that it's pretty easy for these expensive investments to crumble into nothing, again, is to their credit.
So could you argue that there's no harm in Utah going for this rich source of federal tax dollars that would come our way, that did come our way with the 2002 Olympics? I mean, it's part of the reason why we have light rail. That maybe we could cash in again and get some athlete housing up here paid for by federal dollars that could turn into affordable housing for Park City's workforce, which is a big issue in our ski town. Maybe improve our public transit up here, get us some bus rapid express lanes. Is there an argument against why we shouldn't go for those federal tax dollars?
Well, so obviously there's always an argument to be made for getting improvements to your own hometown if someone else pays for it. Now, mind you, I, as a taxpayer here in Massachusetts, don't necessarily want to pay for your light rail. That being said, You know, there is that argument. Some people argue that the Olympics are actually a good thing because it causes local governments actually to spend the money that everyone knows they need to spend, and it kind of gives them that the both, you know, clear deadlines and gives them that push that they need to do these things that they should be doing otherwise. So you do hear that argument a bunch, but of course, yeah, if you can get Washington or Lausanne, Switzerland, to pay for a bunch of your costs, well, absolutely go for that. Certainly, the big thing that you will see the federal government likely pay for is the massive security presence that's going to be needed for an Olympics. Beyond that, I think you are kind of grasping at straws a little bit, assuming that the federal government's going to sweep in and do a bunch of your infrastructure improvements, though.
But that sort of takes me to a related point, which is you mentioned a while ago the notion that it would depend on what the IOC, what kind of a financial arrangement the IOC would reach with the Olympic Organizing Committee. Can you spend just a minute or two on explaining how the economics works in terms of the relationship between the venue city, the organizing committee, and the IOC? Who pays who for what?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a great question. So basically, it works like this: is the host city is responsible for all of the costs of putting on the event. So they need venues, they need security, they need housing, they need media access, they need all of that. And that can be, of course, very expensive. And in Utah, that was roughly $2 billion in 2002 when that all occurred. There are some questions about what should count as costs and what shouldn't. You know, all the widening of the interstate from Salt Lake City up into Park City, should that count as Olympic expenses? Who knows? Let's let the accountants worry about that. So in any case, we got these big set of costs. The host organization is responsible for all of that. Sometimes the host organization is the same as the local government. Sometimes that host organization is a completely private organization. The IOC generally wants at least the local government to say, if the private organizing committee collapses in some ways, that the city will be the backstop and will come in and bail out any problems of the local organizing committee. So that's all the expense side. The revenue side is this. There are all of those sponsorships, you know, Coca-Cola, official sponsor of the Winter Olympics. There are all the tickets you can sell. I actually don't have a good grip on how many tickets get sold on the Winter Olympic side, but on the Summer Olympic side, you sell about 10 million tickets for a total cost of about $1 billion in ticket sales. And then, of course, the big one is all of those media rights, right? So you sell the media rights to all of these different folks. Now, the IOC collects all of the media rights. So all of that big NBC contract, the contract with BBC or whoever they broadcast for in the UK and in China and Australia and all over the world, all of that is money collected by the IOC. Typically, the IOC lets the local organizing committee keep all the ticket money. And then the local organizers collect some of the sponsorship money, and then the IOC collects some of the sponsorship money. All right, so now we got all this money in here. The IOC then decides whether they're going to share any of the money with the local organizing committee. So the organizing committee is on the hook for all the costs. They get most of the ticket money and a little bit of the sponsorship money. And then the IOC is the one who's taking in most of the cash, and they decide whether they're going to share any of that TV cash with the local hosts or whether they're going to keep it all themselves and, you know, buy limousines and gold-plated toilets for all the IOC executive members.
And I take it that that's part of the negotiation, is negotiating that split up front.
And you got that exactly right. So that's all about the negotiation. And, of course, if there are lots and lots of bidders, the IOC doesn't have to give away much of that TV money to get a city willing to host the Olympics and cover all those costs themselves. On the other hand, in a world like we have now where they are really struggling to get host cities, there much more generous in what they're willing to give out. And as a matter of fact, Los Angeles, which just, again, got the 2028 Summer Games, got quite a sweetheart deal and ended up getting something like an extra $500 million or billion extra dollars of media money out of the IOC because the IOC was struggling so much to find anyone to host the Olympics in 2024 and 2028.
What was the breakdown for the 2002 games, those percentages?
So similar. So those aren't at my fingertips, but pretty similar to that, right? So basically $2 billion in costs, all borne by the IOC, the local organizing committee and local governments, roughly a quarter of which was direct subsidy from the state and local governments. The rest was generated, was covered by sponsorships, ticket sales, and their share of TV revenue. So that's roughly how it broke down in 2002.
Dr. Matheson, we've actually gone over our time. It's been so interesting talking to you. Are there any final points you'd like to make to our listeners before we say goodbye?
Yeah, the one thing I would like to say is that we do have some evidence that hosting big events like this does make people happy. This is a fun event. It's very festive. You have self-reported happiness of people in London hosting the game saying, this is a great event for us. But we don't have a whole lot of evidence that it makes us rich.
But happiness is priceless, right?
Happiness is certainly something worth going for. And if the folks in Park City say, you know what, we want to go for this because what a great event to host, I have no problems with that. If the government says, hey, let's do this and spend whatever it takes because anything we spend is going to come back to us in some sort of investment return, that's where I'd say, hold on, let's approach this with a little more caution.
It seems particularly apt that MasterCard was a major sponsor of the 2002 Games, as I recall, given the priceless issue. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Matheson. And can we call you back as things develop? Because I think this is going to be an ongoing issue for us.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about the Olympics anytime. I think it's just a great topic, and it's it's nice to actually talk about an event like a Salt Lake City bid that I might actually be moderately optimistic about because, you know, I don't like being the dismal scientist all the time.
Thank you, Dr. Victor Matheson, Professor of Economics and Accounting with College of the Holy Cross. We'll be talking to you again in the future. The time is now 9:34. Mountain Money will be right back with Element Park City. Stay.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo's been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch Counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We are pleased to have in studio with us our next guest from Element Park City, Patty Johnson and Chef Sebastian Silberice. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank
you.
Good
morning. Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about what Element Park City is. I hope it's not a part of my daughter's chemistry project.
Well, what we are is we're a culinary concierge company that's, you know, just getting going over in the Snow Creek Plaza. We have a couple facets. We're doing some meal kits as well as full service catering and private chef services. I'll let Patty take it from here. She's better at talking than I am.
I think I'm the mouthpiece of the store. So what it is, how we started or how this came to be, Sebastian came into Park City and he had a private chef service and a catering business. The other partner, Lucy Block, she came here from Southern California with an active family who came here because of where we live, our community, the mountains, everything that we have to offer here in Park City. Very busy lifestyle, wanted organic, clean food. In Southern California, she went to a place where it had these meal kits. So we've modeled after that. So in our store, we have a storefront, which is right down from Wasatch Bagel. And so you can come into our store. You can come into our store and you can get grab-and-go items. But we also have delivery Tuesdays and Fridays for these meal kits. So what they are is they are chef-inspired. They are prepared by the chef. From the time you open up your box until you have it on your table is 15 minutes. So it's a little different than Blue Apron and things like that. We've already prepared it. We've cut it. We've chopped it. We've diced it. Some things are sous vide. So when you go, when you come home after running around with the kids, you don't have to go to other places in town to get quick fast food. We have quick fast food that'll be already be in your home, and it's healthy for you.
What's the price range?
The price point per person ranges anywhere between $11 to $16 per person delivered in your home. I was just telling someone a story on Saturday night. I went to a friend's and I brought our trout. It's in parchment paper. Put our oven on at 425, opened up the packages, put it on a cookie sheet. 12 minutes later, we had wonderful trout with sweet potatoes, cauliflower, collard greens, and no cleanup. We rinsed the cookie sheet off and rinsed our dishes and put them in the dishwasher, and dinner was done.
Yeah. The trout sounds excellent. Give us a couple other examples of meals that are particularly that you particularly like, Chef.
Chef?
We've got a braised Berber chicken that I'm a big fan of. It's a chicken quarter, thigh, and leg. It's braised with some onions, pepper, celery, some Ethiopian spices, and it's just tender, fall apart, really easy to heat up. It's nearly impossible to go wrong on this one. Just a little rice, again, you know, 12 to 15 minutes on your plate, ready to go, next to no cleanup. And, you know, it's all healthy, organic, or raised in such a way. You know, part of us working with local farmers is that a lot of them can't afford to go through the certification process. So we go out to the farms, you know, establish relationships with local people to support the community and really, you know, kind of elevate our, you know, the local economy and, you know, our awareness on, you know, social issues, the environment, you know, just have as the widest impact as possible, you know, with our buying power. So, you know, that's one dish that I like. And, you know,
Sebastian, yeah, what is your background as a chef?
Well, I've been in food and beverage for 21 years now, which is really weird to say.
You started when you were 10 because you look really young.
14 is when I got going at an ice cream shop that made our own ice cream and brownies and sandwiches and all that stuff. But been doing it a long time. I lived down in Nashville for quite a while, worked at a bunch of restaurants, some rather large hotels there, opened a few restaurants. A bit of time in Michigan, where I'm from, and I lived out east in Massachusetts for a bit as well. But
what brought you to Park City?
I mean, you look outside when you wake up, and it's really difficult to not. There's no bad side of the bed here. I've got three kids. There's great schools. Everybody's happy. There's tons of opportunity to be had. It's a great place to live. You know, happy to be here.
I particularly have a weakness for something called bakery treats, which I noticed is part of the description that we got. Do the meals come with bakery treats? Or are there something extra? And tell us a little bit about the kinds of bakery treats you have.
So our baked goods are all gluten-free. One of the things that was a really big deal for me, and the bakery items are contingent on being gluten-free only you can't tell. So if it doesn't pass, you know, that smell test, if you will, it just, it doesn't happen. The thing I'm most excited about right now are these wonderful galettes that we're making. It's a kind of a savory baked item. So think like a little pie with, you know, various different things in there. So we've got some with roasted peppers, goat cheese. We've got some with like braised meats, like beef. You know, if you've ever had a Welsh pasty, things along that nature. We've also have some really wonderful amaranth and sesame cookies. If you've ever had a Benet cookie from like the Low Country over in South Carolina, interesting stories there that I won't get into. A lot of history that you had, but you know, those are a couple items. And then we've got some more traditional items. You know, we've got a wonderful flourless chocolate cake. We've got chocolate chip cookies. Beth, my sous chef, cranked out a really great oatmeal and cranberry cookie. You know, peanut butter blondies, truffles.
And you guys are right next to the market, or in the market shopping plaza.
Yes, we're at 1400 Snow Creek Plaza. So we are right of the market and left of Wasatch.
What are your hours?
We are open Saturday to Saturday. I mean, Saturday. Oh, I forgot to give myself a day off. We're closed Sunday. So it's 8 to 8. 8 in the morning till 8 at night.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that I believe you mentioned that you also do private chef services. Is that in-house private chef services that you do?
Yes, we do. We do that on all different levels. We do it from parties of two up to 300 people we can accommodate at this point. We can do. We don't do them in-house. We do them at your house. So
that's the house I meant.
Right, right. Or a venue. Or we can do it at a venue.
But if you're having a party, say not that large, 12, 15 people, and you just want some hot appetizers or something, can you order through your store for something like that?
Yes, we can. And you would call our number, 435-731-8383, and ask for Patty, and I would be more than happy to help you out.
Do you have a website?
Yes, we do. It's www.elementparkcity.com. We also are offering, we have a Thanksgiving offering. So I'll let Chef take it away, but it's a really good value, and you can do add-ons. So if you wanted to add on more meat, let's say if you had more people and you had, you know, Grandma wants to bring her favorite side and Susie wants to bring her favorite side that are traditional in your family, you can pick some of our sides, but you can order extra protein, and we can do that. We also have a vegan option on that as well. Just a little bit, I'm going to backtrack for a minute. On our menu, we'll have 16 items every week. Two will come off every week, and we're rotating them out. Four will be vegan on that menu to choose from. We're doing this because we are sourcing locally. We're partnering with a lot of local people, and as we know, our seasons here, some of them are longer and shorter than others. So we will be switching out our menu so there won't be repetition as well.
Chef, do you do a tofurkey? Tofu, turkey?
Well, part of our product standards is we're not using any GMOs. So that kind of knocks out soybeans and in turn, tofu. I had some, I was macrobiotic for a bit when I was young, and it was a formative experience in me becoming a chef. Not the best food, in my opinion. So I've got feelings about tofu in general, and then it's backed up by the whole GMO thing. But what we're doing is, for our vegan thing on the turkey substitute, we're doing a quinoa and local roasted mushroom stuffed acorn squash. So, you know, we're getting the protein in there, you know, familiar fall flavors, and it's excellent. It's something that's, we've been kind of locking down, you know, as far as tasting and whatnot. So I've been eating it a lot this week.
I'm going to put on my Doug Wells hat, because if he were here, he would say, Mountain Money is a business show, mm-hmm. so we need to ask you some business questions. How did you guys get started? How did you get your mm-hmm. funding together?
So when I started, you know, about a year ago, it was a couple thousand bucks for pictures. And, you know, we've segued that into about, you know, right around 100K in revenue in the first year. Wow. And, you know, I'm a positive thinker. So I started looking for a commercial space. And, you know, some folks say that when you put things out in the universe, you know, it responds. And Lucy came into my world at that point. And we started talking, and, you know, really there was some great synergy between us. You know, we believed in a lot of the same things, you know, with the product sourcing, delivering excellent food while maintaining, you know, kind of a you know, maintaining an idea of social responsibility around it. And so we put our heads together. It was only about 4 months ago. And we've been busting our butts, cranking this thing out, you know, trying to get there before season rolled around. And, you know, taking our time to make sure that it was right, you know, as best we could.
Any challenges that surprised you?
Finding organic non-GMO oil has been probably the biggest headache I've had. Yeah, because you've got several of the largest GMO crops. We got corn, rapeseed, or canola, and soy. Yeah. Those are your basic oils. You know, in a previous life, I would get 35-pound jug of oil for anywhere between like $20 and $40, depending on what it was and how the market was looking. And now it's substantially more expensive than that if I could find it. So it seems, and it's been a, the sourcing, you know, mm-hmm. has been probably the most difficult and time-consuming part of this venture, you know.
What about marketing, advertising? Mm-hmm. Are you finding it hard to get the word out there about Element Park City?
No. The community has been very responsive, you know. You know, we haven't, you know, beaten ourselves about the head about it too much. But
so you're pleased with
here.
The traffic that's coming through the door right now?
Oh, yeah. And I think we have one of the better locations in town for what we're doing. Imagine another place that would work better.
Is most of your business coming through the door or online or phone calls? How are you getting business?
We've been working with some other property managers in town, and you know, based upon my past business, and that's really been driving our, you know, the private chef thing up until now. We have you know, a really great website that my wife designed. And you know, and Patty's been a wonderful ambassador as well, you know.
And I take it all those will segue into marketing for the ski season as well.
Yes, yes.
And well, Sundance, you're going to have a lot of Sundance yeah. people who come in, yeah.
Yep, yep.
Well, Patty Johnson and Chef Sebastian Silberice, thank you for spending time with us. We've appreciated your giving us some information about Element Park City, and I suspect I will be stopping by to pick up a meal very soon.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And coming up right after these underwriters, you're going to hear how to organize your closet. Stay tuned.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud KPCW supporter.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays!
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money on KPCW. The time is 9:50. I'm Renee Bodley, here with Roger Goldman, our guest co-host for this Monday, sitting in for Doug Wells. Our next guests are Ann Martin and Chris Hanneman with Get Organized. These ladies will come in. They call themselves serial organizers, which as a control enthusiast myself, I like that explanation. I just told you guys that a friend of mine won your gift certificate in our pledge drive. And she came in to pick it up on Friday, and she said, I have to spend all weekend cleaning to get ready for Chris and Ann to come in. Do you have to clean for you guys?
Absolutely not. We actually prefer the bigger the mess, the better. And just because then that way we can come in and see all of your items and really get down and dirty and sort through things and help you out. But no, it's funny because that's actually one of our biggest obstacles is that people are nervous for us to come in because they do feel like they have to clean and prepare for us. But then that's our job. So please don't do it. So no, please don't clean your home before we come.
Can you give us a little about the philosophy of the organizing principles behind organizing?
Sure, be happy to. So the idea here is that, you know, over time, we accumulate things and life is busy and we don't have as much time to put things away in a thoughtful way. So things get shoved in cupboards and cabinets and closets. And after a while, you're kind of consumed by all of this clutter. And it's not like a hoarder situation. It's more that you just have so much that all of a sudden it becomes difficult to find what you need or to get out of the house. And you just become less efficient and you spend and waste a lot of time looking for things. Or you end up buying more things because you can't find what you're looking for, right? We've all been there. So the idea is you know, we go in and we work with people to help them declutter and sort through their items. And it can be a home office, it can be kitchen, it can be an entire home. We go room by room, look through the items, see what do you use, what do you need, and what do you love. And anything else is clutter.
Do we have to ask that question? Does it bring me joy?
You certainly can, but you don't have to. It's really just looking at it and going, okay, do I need it? Do I use it? Do I love it? And if it fits into those three categories, then keep it. And we'll find a place for it and put it in a place that makes sense so it's easy to find and access and clean up. But if it doesn't fall into those categories, it's clutter.
Do you have any rules of thumb, like if I haven't touched it in 2 years, I probably don't need it?
Yep.
We actually prefer if you haven't touched it in a year, you probably don't need it. There are those situations that, you know, we all are emotionally attached to certain things. And we actually, when we go through and we sort with our clients, we have a bin that's called the stew pot. And if you put things in the stew pot and at the end of our time of decluttering, you're still not ready to make a decision about it, totally okay. Go ahead, put it in a tub, tuck it somewhere, but then let's revisit it in a year and see if your feelings have changed about it. And if they have, then it's time to donate it and repurpose it and give it to somebody who could actually use it.
I'm gaping a little bit just because it sounds like you're part therapist.
Well, it's funny that you say that. Both Anne and I studied psychology in college and decided not to pursue it as a profession. And we have giggled about that, how, wow, this is really interesting. It's now coming into play because there are emotions involved. There's guilt, frustrations and all of that. So you have to work through that. And then we've seen it so many times that once we get there and they're like, okay, actually I'm just hanging on to this because I feel guilty that I bought it, but I really don't like it. Or I'm hanging on to this because someone passed it down and I never use it, but I'm afraid to get rid of it. Once they get past that, they're fine. They're animals then. They clean it out, clear it out because they see the relief, right? It feels so good to get all that baggage out.
We've had a few customer or clients that once we've kind of pulled the Band-Aid, it's like opening the floodgates, and they are in there with us, and they're going crazy. And after our time is up with them, they'll send us pictures and say, look what I did with my mudroom now, and look what I did with this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're so excited because they keep the momentum going after our job is done.
And, you know, another part of that is that's interesting. We do a follow-up to see how our organization systems are working, right? It's, you know, are things set up in such a way that it's easy to maintain? And every single time, everyone has said, oh, I don't even remember what I got rid of. The stuff just didn't matter. So it was just helping them through that process of, okay, now it's time and how to look at the items, right? Do I use it, love it, or need it? And once they get there, then they purge it.
And So how long a process, and I realize it would obviously vary with the size of the job, but give us sort of a rule of thumb or a typical project where you come into someone's home and they say, I'm a total mess, help me work through this, and what are the steps?
So typically, for example, a kitchen, so including someone's pantry, that is typically about an 8-hour job. Something like that. A playroom, child's playroom, again, depending on the size, I would say that's about six and a half hours. Mudroom, what would you say, 4 hours?
Yeah, 4 to 6 hours. And every single item is pulled out. Every drawer is emptied. Every little nook and cranny is pulled out. And it's every item is looked at and then either discarded, kept, or donated. And good.
And then part of that is also setting up a system going forward, correct, right, for how to store and use things, I take it.
Absolutely. So it depends on the customer. We try to use what they already have in most cases, but in some cases, people do want us to go down to the container store, which of course we love to do, and buy all the pretty shiny new things and make up labels for them. But again, we work within everyone's budget, whether it be using their existing items or, you know, going to Target, Walmart, or the container store. And then so we set things up. We kind of map out how we think things would flow really well in the room. And then once we get our client's approval, we set everything up. They take one last look at it, and then we label everything for them. So everything has a home.
Who is your typical customer? Do you work more with women, men, families?
We work mostly with women. But our customers are kind of fairly broad in the sense that we have people who are just moving into town and they want their home set up right the first time. We have people who are downsizing, looking to get rid of things. We have young families who are really, really busy and they've got kids and sports and activities and careers and they need to streamline their home life. How do you get out of the house? How does everybody get out of the house quickly, efficiently, easily, without stress in the morning? And when you come home at night, how do you get that meal on the table quickly? You do that by having these systems in place where you can just come in, bam, get your meal on the table. So yeah, so it's families, professionals, elderly, young families. I mean, it's everybody.
And then we also, sorry, we do have a clientele that when they're getting ready to put their home on the market, we can actually go in and help them declutter, whether that be just put their things in storage so that their home is show ready, or if it's actually getting rid of some items as well.
We only have a couple minutes left. This is a loaded question. Have you ever had a client where you said, I'm sorry, you're beyond help?
No.
Not so far.
No.
Oh, well, that didn't take so long to answer as I thought it would.
No, but, you know, we've walked into a couple doozies, you know, but we got through it. And at the end, the relief that the client felt was unbelievable. They were so pleased, and it was just like a weight lifted off their shoulders because they knew they had too much and they weren't functioning well.
Do you have relationships that help people get rid of stuff? In other words, to be able to donate it or otherwise, you know, put it to a good use?
So, well, we typically, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question right, but we typically ask if they have a preference as to where they'd like their donation to go. And if they don't, we go to usually the Christian Center here in town or the Recycle Center. So those are our top two.
Anything else you want to add? We've got about 30 seconds left.
Clear space, clear mind. Think about it.
Thank you. That's Ann Martin, Chris Hanneman. They're with Get Organized. Their website is getorganizedpc.com. Thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And we need to wrap up. We should also thank our sponsors, Roger.
Absolutely. First of all, I want to thank you for letting me join you this morning, and I want to thank our sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and Vacasa of Park City.
And thank you to our guests. We started off the hour with Dr. Victor Matheson, Professor of Economics and Accounting at the College of the Holy Cross. He's written a lot about the economic viability of the Olympics. Utah's looking at making another bid. Potentially, we'll know by February of next year if we're going to go for it. That's going to be real exciting, Roger. Our second guest, Patty Johnson, and Chef Sebastian Silberice with Element Park City. And, of course, Ann Martin and Chris Hanneman with Get Organized. That's on Mountain Money. If you tuned in halfway through the show and you want to hear more, we'll have this show posted on our website, kpcw.org. And before we go, just a quick reminder, if you're listening to this program, this is one of seven public affairs programs that we bring you here at KPCW Park City. We're a nonprofit, local, community-owned radio station. Live PC, Give PC is coming up November 10th. That's that day where everyone reaches in their pockets and gives to their favorite nonprofit in town. We hope KPCW is one of them. If you want to donate, you can do so now, kpcw.org. NPR News comes up right now.